Welcome to April and Spring with Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to remind you that the top 10 Royals, Rebels, and Romantics in Love is available on my website. It's free. Just go to carolannloyd.com and you can grab your copy today. I also want to thank my patrons for all of their support and invite all of you to join our Patreon family. We've got some great things coming up, some special content, bonus episodes, new courses, and all kinds of stuff. Now, please sit back and enjoy this great new episode. And if you would be willing to share with a friend, maybe subscribe and I'll leave a rating, that would be great. But in any case, thank you for joining me and enjoy the upcoming episodes of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. I am here with Dr. Sean Cunningham of the National Archives. Welcome to the podcast. I'm thrilled you're here with us.
I'm really pleased to be here, Carol. Thank you.
Well, I want to mention, of course, it's not being published today, but I do want to mention, because we are recording this the day after the anniversary of the birth and sadly death of Elizabeth of York, who will play an important role in our discussion of early Tudor history. So just want to mention that in passing. But tell us about, first, a little bit about yourself, how you became so interested in history, your path to working at the archives, and some of your story before we jump into the Tudor story.
Yes, I suppose it's something that attracts everyone's interest. At some point, you find the subject which really makes you enthusiastic and connects you to the past. So for me, I was studying history at university, always found it was one of my favorite subjects, but didn't really have a focus, didn't really have a passionate time period or individual or event or place. And then I kind of got drawn into the whole Richard III debate. My tutor at the time had written some things on Richard III, and we had a special subject. And diving really deeply into that story made me think, oh, there's a lot going on in late medieval Europe, late medieval England, which has kind of some resonance to modern times, the politics, the factions, the kind of scheming, as well as the big picture things we all know about. So that made me want to look even further at what was going on around that time. How was that kind of story possible in the circumstances of the late 15th century? Then obviously it all folds into what happens afterwards and how history passes on from that moment into bigger and different things. So from that point on, I was kind of hooked in that period. And then I went on to do a master's degree and then a PhD and thinking, well, I'm never going to get a job doing this. So I'll just run it out as long as I can, see if I can just become an interested historian or someone who likes to read. But then things coincided with an opportunity, and I'd done a little bit of work in a kind of bookshop management, and then getting bookshop management with, actually we were closing down the old archives in London to move them out to Kew in Southwest London, where the current site is. So it was moving the old records and the legal records out to the new building. So there was a job linked to that process, and it was sort of setting up the new medieval and early modern service in the new archive building. And that's the job I got about more than 20 years ago. So from that moment on, I've been kind of digging around in the archives and doing my own research at the same time. So it's been a fantastic career, getting a job that pays you for your passion. So I think for that sense, I've never wanted to move on, really. It's always been endlessly fascinating. And of course, all those other periods of history and the records about them have come into the picture as well. So history has become even more fascinating just because of that.
Well, that is wonderful. And for those of you who haven't taken the opportunity, the archives do some wonderful online talks as well. And so those of us living in the States really appreciate the opportunity to see those. So we thank you for sharing them and sharing those moments of the archives. And also, I'll just give a shout out. The archives are very welcoming. I've done some research there, and I'm going back later this year to do some research. And people are very helpful and wonderful. So I do want to give a big thanks to the archives. And let's talk a little bit about your research. So I wanted to sort of dive into some of the early Tudors with you. And when we look at Henry Tudor, who becomes Henry VII, that path to the throne is sort of a long and winding road, to put it mildly. So what made it possible? You mentioned Richard III, but set it up for us so that this guy who's been in exile for 14 years can somehow end up on the English throne. How is that possible?
It is one of those amazing stories of the past where someone who shouldn't really have any claim and shouldn't really be in a position to bring people to support him ends up becoming king and pushes aside all these other candidates. So it's a great story that needs to be kind of raised up the scale of achievements, I think, from that period, because it shouldn't have happened, and yet it did. And there's all kinds of factors. I think just thinking about his backstory, it makes it even more obvious that it's a surprise. And I guess it's some kind of recognition of his abilities to come out of exile and galvanize these people and bring them all on board. But some of that's down to circumstances. So, yes, I mean, he has a strange family history in that his father's line goes back into Welsh, North Wales, and the kind of Tudors as landholders goes back a long way. But it's not what you'd pick up as a kind of English royal line, in that the lordship they have is very self-contained and links to the Principality of Wales more than the Westminster crown. He's got through his mother, Margaret Beaufort, he's got a connection to Edward III, but that's through the Beaufort family, who have had a troubled history in the Wars of the Roses as the leaders of Henry VI's faction and the Lancastrian cause, and mainly because of the loss of the lands in France in the 1440s and 50s. The Beauforts are kind of fingered as the people who were responsible for the end of the English Empire in France. But Henry's connection there is through the female line. So it's tenuous. And they've obviously were born as illegitimate as children of Catherine Swinford and John of Gaunt, Edward III's son. So that kind of relationship is there in the mix, but you would never say it was a prominent thing that could be put forward as a principal claim. And then he has this connection to Henry VI through his father and his uncle Jasper, who are children of Henry V's widow, Catherine of Valois, who was also Henry VI's mother. But that obviously doesn't bring any kind of connection to the Lancastrian royal family. So it's just an association. Henry VI kind of adopts them as his blood nephews, even though they're half-blood nephews. And they become fairly prominent at court and are given lots of responsibility in South Wales, Jasper Tudor especially. Edmund Tudor dies before Henry VII, Henry Tudor is even born. But he marries Margaret Beaufort, so that brings those two lines together. So Margaret is really the key to all of this, I suppose, in that she is a woman who's had to fight her way through giving birth when she was a young teenager, being widowed when she was 13, but then being falling under the protection of the Stafford family, and eventually marrying Lord Stanley, another powerful noble with lands in the northwest. So she is very much in the centre of politics during this period of the Wars of the Roses, when factions and disputes actually slide into civil war and people have to decide whose side they're on, supporting Henry VI staying on the throne or supporting Richard, Duke of York, the third Duke of York, who's claiming another line of descent from Edward III, and his other sons, to claim that the York line should have been superior to the Lancastrian line, which took the throne by force in 1399. So it's a century already of discord and rival claims, occasionally flaring up into battles. Henry Tudor is born in 1457 in the middle of all of this, really before things have kicked off. There's been one street fight at St. Albans in 1455 when the Beauforts are targeted as the bad councillors around the king. So the York faction has kind of amalgamated into action to try and erase their rivals at court. And then there's an attempt to smooth that over and maybe bring factions together, but it does get more violent at the end of the 1450s, early 1460s. There's several battles, 1459 to 61. Henry Tudor is just a child, is not involved in any of this, but his mother obviously is trying to navigate her way through it to make sure that her and her children are safe, her child is safe, I should say. He's the only child she has. And from that sense, he sees this as his background. So when he's growing up, even though he's not growing up in England, as we'll talk about, this conflict frames his kind of early life and makes him think about how people relate to each other in positions of power around the court, how they run counties for the crown, how they look after their own interests by managing their own estates, and then those marriage contracts, those negotiations for alliances and kind of friendships. All of this is the kind of bread and butter of being a late medieval aristocrat, noble. You have to navigate and learn all of these relationships, how to manage them. So Henry is kind of on the cusp of all of this, but in a way, the Civil War overtakes his life, and he's kind of made a ward of court, a ward of the court. So Henry is put to become a ward of William Herbert after 1461, when the Lancastrians are defeated at the Battle of Towton. The York faction becomes the dominant force, and Edward, Earl of March, becomes King Edward IV. And so the Yorkists are triumphant, the Lancastrians are scattered. Some flee overseas with Queen Margaret of Anjou, some go to France, and some just basically are absorbed into society and keep their heads down. Henry is one of those as a young child living in the Marches of Wales with the Herbert family, mainly living with Anne Devereux, William Herbert's wife, because Herbert himself is killed in the next phase of civil war in 1469, and by which stage Henry is 12 years old, beginning to understand what's going on. So this is a period where we don't know much about what he's doing, but he's living in England with another family, actually learning how to fit into a household, how to make friends. He becomes fairly friendly with some nobles, who then go on to greater things through their marriages. But he's not got any kind of power or profile. It's only again when civil war returns in 1470, 1469, 70, 71, that he's kind of thrown back into the mix, because the other Lancastrian figures have either died during the 1460s, made their peace with Edward IV, or have gone overseas to sort of await things happening. And when Edward is deposed, because the Earl of Warwick, his former ally, rebels and brings, amazingly, the Lancastrians back as his allies to depose Edward IV, Henry is then suddenly brought forward again, as because of that half-blood connection to Henry VI, maybe as a figure who could be put into the profile of the court to be a binding kind of figure, to bring people on board, to maybe say, look, I've lived a little bit of time as a Yorkist, and I've got this family background as a Lancastrian. I've proved you can work towards a kind of peaceful and harmonious balance of interests. And he's reunited with his mother. Obviously, he's been a ward. She's still alive. Henry VI comes back on the throne, but it only lasts about 9-10 months. And then there's another round of battles. Henry is again separated. He has to flee overseas with Jasper Tudor. They live in exile in Brittany from 1471 right through to 1484, when he goes to France for a few months and then comes back as a claimant in 1485. So that route to the throne, it's in great waves of connection, disconnection, isolation. I think he learns a lot in Brittany by watching how politics works. Brittany, by this stage, is a semi-independent duchy. The King of France, Louis XI, wants to absorb it into the French kingdom. But there is a kind of tension on the frontier, a recurring frontier war, which England is kind of involved in, sending archers to support the Bretons or to maybe not support them, depending on how diplomacy is going. But Henry is there as a little pawn in all of this. Once he's in exile, both Edward IV and Richard III can use that position to try and gain influence with the Bretons, maybe to get Henry back, because he and Jasper, because they're figures who are loose ends, I suppose, rather than any real threat. And he wants them under his control. Certainly Edward IV tries quite hard in the 1470s. But politics kind of moves on, and in a way they're insignificant in the bigger picture. It's only after Edward IV dies in April 1483 that Henry is suddenly catapulted into the spotlight, really, because by that stage a lot of people have died away. There isn't really a figurehead for the opposition side of things. No one expects Edward V, the Prince of Wales, not to become king. He's been living on the Marches of Wales, which is the area Henry knows. He's been living at Ludlow Castle, being trained to kind of be a king by looking after his own lands and running his own court, which is the best kind of on-the-job training, I guess, without real risks of making mistakes. He has a council and a lot of friends around him to support him. But then Richard III suddenly decides that Edward IV's marriage wasn't valid, and all of his children with Elizabeth Woodville, his wife, are all illegitimate. So he can claim that he's saving the country from an illegitimate underage king, because everyone can be informed about, you know, what happened in the past when child monarchs were on the throne, and what chaos could follow. So he claims the throne for himself, and a lot of people who oppose that, who wanted to see Edward V as the king, they rebel against King Richard in the autumn of 1483. And Henry is prepared by the Bretons to sail across and join this rebellion and become a figurehead. In a way, he's the kind of inspiration for it. It's all organized by Margaret Beaufort and Elizabeth Woodville. By this stage, she probably believes that her sons are dead, that Richard III, when he becomes king, he possibly has them prepared for a role in his coronation procession, but they suddenly become much less visible in the Tower of London, and eventually they're not seen anymore. And we all know the debate about whether they survived or not. But for practical purposes, at that moment, people rebelled because they thought they weren't there to be a rival faction to Richard. And therefore, Henry Tudor is kind of brought into the picture to pick up some of that, almost as a person without any baggage, without any kind of factionalism behind him, despite this Lancastrian bloodline. He is kind of promoted as an alternative and someone around whom these desperate people who've rebelled against Richard and been defeated by effectively bad weather. There's a terrible autumn of storms in 1483, and they can't bring all their soldiers together. And the royal forces kind of pick and separate the rebels. I think the Duke of Buckingham might have thought he might have had a chance to sort of take the rebellion so far and then jump in and claim the throne for himself. He's another one with a link back to Edward III and royal blood in his own veins. But that doesn't come to pass. He's captured and executed at the start of November. And Richard feels that he's put this revolution, this rebellion to bed. He then sets out on a much more stable kind of program of ruling. And Henry Tudor is sent back to Brittany to try and pick up the pieces. He promises to marry Elizabeth of York, Edward IV's daughter, obviously believing that she is not illegitimate, that she's the last surviving heir of the House of York. If you assume still, as they must have done, that the two boys, Edward and Richard, were dead in the tower. So that gives a platform for those Yorkists to think, okay, we'll lend our support to Henry Tudor through his intended bride as the heir of the House of York. And then any children they have will merge that claim into a possible new ruling house or dynasty. That's all in the future and part of the plans and the promises Henry makes to restore them to the throne. But they've got nothing to lose, really. They're going to be possibly returning in fits and starts if Richard can negotiate with them directly. Some of them he won't want back in England, and some of them will have faced arrest and trial and possible execution had they gone back without being invited. So the momentum kind of builds as a standoff between this rebel exile group who Henry is kind of building up over about a year and a half. He manages to bring together these Yorkist rebels and the Lancastrians who've all been hanging around Europe, like the Earl of Oxford, you know, who's escaped from imprisonment in Calais and is kind of waiting for his chance. But he never made any kind of reconciliation with Edward IV. So there's some diehard, you know, believers in the old rites of usurping house in 1399, but nevertheless, they still have this same Plantagenet kind of connection. It's just which degree you believe has the superior claim. So they're kind of waiting for this chance. And I think certainly in 1485, Richard III is almost desperate for this chance to finally defeat this whole range of rebels that are coming in behind Henry Tudor. And in a way, he kind of invites that invasion, knowing that he's going to have superior forces and is able to defeat Henry and wipe out all of this opposition. And Richard is still a fairly young man in his early 30s, so he might have thought 20 years plus of stable kingship can come if only I can knock out all these opponents in one go. So he brings a massive army together at Nottingham and then moves it to Leicester, kind of in the middle of the country, waiting for wherever Henry Tudor and his small force lands. And it's probably only about 2,000 soldiers that come over from France at the start of August 1485. Maybe only 500 of them are British. Most of them will be French mercenaries, other mercenaries from Italy and Germany, because that's where the companies were. So he basically picks up support when he lands on the 7th of August in Wales, marches up the coast and across to Shrewsbury. The Stanleys begin to join him, but obviously they can only reveal a certain amount of connection because some of them are in prison with the King's court and under threat of execution. So Henry's kind of picking up all this support as he marches along, but his army is still only about 6,000, Richard's army maybe 12,000 plus at the Battle of Bosworth. And the Stanleys are sitting on a hill in between watching to see what happens with another army of maybe 6,000. So in the balance of numbers, you can see why if Richard and Henry had just fought, it would have been a foregone conclusion. But right. With the Stanleys there, you know, waiting, it still looks like Richard should just, you know, wipe them away as he marches. But all kinds of factors on the day of the battle prevent that royal army from actually fighting effectively. And Henry basically just waits. The battle really doesn't move forward as a decisive thing. It kind of reaches a stalemate. I think Richard gets frustrated that his soldiers aren't doing what he wants them to do, and he kind of rides out in a charge towards Henry Tudor's flags on the battlefield and gets bogged down in the fighting. And at that moment, the Stanleys decide they're going to back Tudor and not Richard. And that's why Henry Tudor becomes Henry VII in that. He works his way through all these problems. He overcomes all these obstacles. He narrowly avoids being caught and captured several times. He avoids being caught and captured in England. People are willing to kind of facilitate his march. He manages to avoid getting killed in the battle. And, you know, only just Richard III dies, probably within a few feet of him on the battlefield. And basically he's made king because he's to a lot of people, a less problematic ruler than King Richard. And that's really when his problems start, I guess, because he can't claim the thrones through ancestry or descent. He can only show this kind of rag bag of collections and ancestors who together might have had a reasonable kind of claim, but there's all sorts of problems with how you put that together. He basically says, I'm king because I won the battle. And God's judgment is that I should be king because he allowed me to kill the bad king who was there before me. And from that point, he's challenging people to accept that. So really, yes. The Tudor origin story is like, in terms of royal claims, you know, it comes out of nowhere, really. And it only happens because Edward IV dies prematurely. Richard III takes the throne, the opposition to that process. And just happens to form around Henry because he's the only candidate who can kind of offer something. He demonstrates all that skill in putting that package together to challenge Richard.
Yes.
And that's where his royal abilities kind of grow from. But he's never run any estates. He's never been in charge of a court. He's never been given responsibility for running a region like so many of these other nobles would have done. He has no direct royal connection other than through his mother. So as an individual, I mean, he confesses this to the Venetian ambassador quite early in his reign. You know, he doesn't have any experience of England. He doesn't want to change anything in England. You know, he's a man who's basically acquired the throne purely through his own abilities. And he's got to try and keep it. And that's the challenge the Tudors then have.
Yes.
Having unexpectedly got to the point of running the country, they've got a man with no experience on the job. How do they then stay in power when the nature of that battle at Bosworth only was about Richard III and his close household friends fighting as a sort of bodyguard almost? So they're the ones that died. The rest of his army kind of stands and watches, and Henry's now got to deal with all of these people who might have been good friends of Richard but couldn't fight for him, but might have harboured this guilt for having not supported their king when they had the chance. Are they going to then do it when, you know, Henry Tudor is now the king? Can they kick him off the throne and get a better candidate on? So Tudor's problems really start in the autumn of 1485. And then what happens for the next 24 years or so is a process of keeping the throne and building up something that the next Tudor heir can inherit in a much more stable way. And that's really what Henry VII's reign is about. It's not about him necessarily. It's about squashing down this threat, stabilizing the country, and making sure that the next Tudor monarch enjoys all the benefits of that kind of hardship and sacrifice. And that, even that doesn't go the way he plans.
But, no. Not exactly, because he doesn't anticipate his son Henry inheriting. There's a different son we'll talk about. But I do think it's really interesting that right from the start, Henry Tudor's plan is this union with the Yorkist. And that comes from his having lived. You mentioned that he lived in a Yorkist household. He made friends with Yorkist household members and nobles. And just like his mother, Margaret Beaufort, who certainly manages through the Wars of the Roses to be in favor on both sides. So there's this ability that maybe she passed on to him to get along with Yorkists and Lancastrians. And that's how this framework is put together. But as you say, it's not the end. He doesn't sort of win the Battle of Bosworth and now the hard times are behind him. In fact, they're just ahead. So as he tries to settle everything and get it ready for the next generation, he does marry Elizabeth of York after he's crowned on his own. That's very important. Wants to be crowned on his own first. Gets Elizabeth to be legitimate again. Marries her as he had promised to do. And then is certain he will have a son. And he goes to quite a bit of effort to have the son born at Winchester in the place of King Arthur and taps into that Welsh history. So tell us a little bit about the importance. He is very successful, as Henry VIII is not, in immediately providing that healthy male heir to succeed him. So tell us a little bit about Arthur and what baby Prince Arthur represents in Henry VII's desire and ability to stabilize himself on the throne.
Yes, you can see a lot of what's expected in the way that Arthur is, well, Arthur, preparations for Arthur's birth, but also the whole apparatus around that birth. And it's another massive gamble, really. Henry, having won Bosworth, I think genuinely does believe that God is on his side. Because he himself would have probably assessed his prospects as so unfavorable that only intervention from above could have actually made all these things possible. So why wouldn't he think it would carry on and he'd be given all those other benefits of sort of providence and fortune? So he does marry Elizabeth. He doesn't crown her. She doesn't get crowned till November 1487 after another battle. So he is there. Definitely king in his own right. Excuse me. Definitely king in his own right to start with. And his promise to marry Elizabeth has got him over the line almost. And it's a risk not to make her queen at the same time. Although she's, you know, title queen, but she isn't crowned queen. So that anointing and crowning is an important thing. And Richard III had, you know, had been married when he became king, but Queen Anne was crowned at the same time as him in July 1483. So he knew that together, that kind of amalgamation of secular and religious power is important. So Henry marries Elizabeth and she gets pregnant straight away. And Arthur is born maybe a few weeks prematurely in September. Sorry. A few weeks prematurely in September 1486. In the summer, in expectation of the birth, the whole court moves to Winchester, precisely as you say, because of this association with Arthur and Camelot. There is a round table in Winchester Great Hall from this period, was probably a bit earlier, but Henry is tapping into this story of the once and future king and the great resister to invaders, the great galvanizer, the great figurehead of British resistance. And Henry can't really sell the Welsh ancestry through his own bloodline to the English political elite, but they've been buying William Caxton's, you know, version of Thomas Malory's Morte d'Arthur in printed form. It only was just printed in Richard III's reign. It's kind of the best, one of the best sellers of histories. So everybody in the court circles who was reading would have known about, you know, King Arthur being kind of hot news at the time, I guess. And that's why Henry chooses Arthur as the given name for his son. It's a spectacular choice. You know, there's only been a couple of instances in the past of an Arthur, Arthur Brittany and one of John's nephews. You know, it's not a traditional English aristocratic, even royal name, certainly. So there's definitely some marketing propaganda some steps being taken here to attach the Tudors to a much older line of English British rulers, looking back to kind of this time when myth and history is merging together through the kind of just waiting for that email to go past. It's definitely going back to those chronicle sources, those older histories which people would have heard about, but trying to make that a realistic and relevant line to the kings who are actually in power in the Middle Ages. So I think there's also an element of the Queen's ancestry in this as well, because certainly the Yorkists and Edward IV had a similar interest in King Arthur in Britain. And so Elizabeth of York is also the heir of the Mortimer line at this stage. And they are great powers on the Welsh marches too. And certainly Edward IV as Earl of March was basically, you know, a landowner and had been brought up and had strong connections in this region in a similar way to Henry himself. Actually, that's his only familiar region in England, is the same kind of borderland of England and Wales. So Elizabeth's family have got this lineage as well. And I think maybe Henry is borrowing that also, as he's just borrowed her actual ancestry for his son. So Prince Arthur is born September, a little bit early. Margaret Beaufort makes a lovely entry in her Book of Hours to show he's born. It's a very risky thing. I mean, even if it's a healthy girl baby, it's not quite the same opportunity to sell all of this military sort of leadership, all the things which everybody knows King Arthur had achieved. It has to be bound up in a prince. And so the whole ceremony as well, thanks to kind of heralds reporting of what was going on, we can actually see who was there, who had roles. And it is a great set piece spectacle about bringing Lancaster and York together, with the Queen's sisters all given prominent roles, the Yorkist nobility. In fact, because Arthur is premature, they have to send a kind of express message to the Earl of Oxford, who's over in East Anglia, to ride right across the country to take his role. It's quite a muddy autumn again with rains. So he only just gets there in time, but it's clear they need the kind of Lancastrian and Tudor supporters to be there with the Yorkists to kind of reforge the whole court and therefore the whole country, because these people will be passing their messages of harmony and kind of a new beginning back down to their tenants and their courtiers in their own lands. You know, these are all landowners who've been built up by the Yorkists to kind of run regions on behalf of the crown. So the ones that are still around or just inherited or just recovered their estates, you know, grateful to the Tudors for doing that to them, now that Prince Arthur is there as the next generation, you know, they are behind that because it confirms their choice. That was a good choice. And it gives them the opportunity then to work with Henry VII and this infant prince to kind of build up that solid foundation for a new kind of kingship. Right. Which I think Henry is always calculating how this is going to work, because he doesn't take Arthur back to Westminster or Sheen or the sort of London-based Thames Valley houses. A couple of weeks old, he's sent to Farnham Palace. So he's brought up again, separated from his family with his own household as an infant. He's brought up by the team of nurses that have brought up all the Yorkist children. So again, another sense of continuity. But from the age up to about the age of, I guess, 5 or 6, he's living in Farnham, not doing very much as far as we can tell, having an education appropriate to his age. But the plan is to reproduce that Yorkist way of training a king, to send him to Ludlow Castle, to basically give him a region to begin to learn how to rule. And he's sent there in the spring of 1493, aged about just about 6 or 5 and a half, 6, to really begin the process of a kind of classroom learning experience with this practical learning the ropes of being a lord, running the law, running estates, running personalities in the court, learning how to navigate all of these factors which allow a leader to emerge from the kind of hard knocks of being in charge, from a very early age. This is the age where, you know, teenage princes, if you think of Prince Henry V when he's young, fighting, you know, in Glyndwr's Rebellion, you know, Edward IV himself becomes king when he's a teenager, as Henry VIII does, but in other circumstances we can talk about. So responsibility comes young for these young men. And through the Wars of the Roses, you've got Prince Edward of Lancaster, you know, champing at the bit to get in a fight when he's 14, and it costs him his life after the Battle of Tewkesbury, and he's still only 16 then. So, you know, there's no kind of allowance given for these aristocratic boys being quite young. And so Arthur's learning that kind of world from a fairly early age, and by the time he's sort of 15, he's ready to be, you know, he's equipped to be king, even though circumstances don't allow that. But his training and his education has really been quite intensive to that point. And all of that process is also bound up in his sense of preparing the next reign. And Henry yeah. VII's rule, to some extent, is, as we all maybe talk about, is blocking off challenges, is ending conspiracies. It's about the pretenders that emerge who are claiming to be these other Yorkist figureheads. And most of his reign is firefighting these problems. There's never really more than a year and a half where things look calm before the next wave of crisis hits him. So he's constantly trying to sort of remove Arthur from that problematic center of power, give him a bit more space and calmness to develop his skills, and also make sure he's aware of how the politics of all this works. I think we've lost so much of the paperwork, of the letters, all of the household accounts for Arthur's household, you know, a lot of the relationship he has with Catherine of Aragon, his wife, when she comes over in November 1501. All of that is certainly not been found. So we get no sense of Arthur really as a personality. We just see the kind of apparatus for his life and assume quite a lot about how he fitted into that. But he looks like he was prepared to rule in the same kind of way that his father hadn't been. So, you know, he might mm-hmm. still have a similar personality. He would certainly have been taught about the importance of learning all the ropes of government and learning how all the machinery fits together and how the whole thing actually has to work to keep the country running. And he's had the chance to learn that in smaller but increasingly bigger scale kind of operations. But we don't really get a sense of him as a person until, you know, he's in the spotlight for his wedding at the end of 1501. But it looks like he's, you know, he would have been a very well-trained king, not perhaps spectacular. Certainly wouldn't have had the opportunity for that kind of military conquest like Edward IV had done, kind of forging his reputation, you know, physically in the heat of battle. So he wouldn't have been a Henry V. But who knows what might have happened, you know, had he gone on to be king. He might have developed these characteristics through necessity, as Henry, his father, had done, you know, with Bosworth and all the battles he had to fight to keep the throne after 1485. So, Arthur is a fascinating subject just because what could have been, and also what then had to happen when he wasn't around. So,
yes, because so much was based on him as, you know, the first son and Arthur, and then Henry VII had such a coup when he arranged for the marriage to Catherine of Aragon. All of that was, you know, focused on the future. And then it all sort of falls apart potentially. So while he's setting up Arthur, there are rebellions, there's all this stuff he's taking care of, as you, whoever was behind it, we won't get into the whole prince's debate right now, but whoever was behind it, we have some significant rebellions that Henry VII has to put down. And Arthur's death, though, really seems to be devastating to both Henry and Elizabeth of York, and does sort of change that future. So can you take us in, you know, it's 1502, he's been married, this glorious marriage where everyone's had a chance to see him, and people have fallen in love with Catherine of Aragon too. You know, she was very popular as this princess and young couple, very popular. And then it just has such a terrible ending, that story. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, that that negotiation for the marriage started almost as soon as Henry VII becomes king. He sees the need, or recognizes the Spanish monarchs rather than the French or the Burgundians as being a rising power because of their claims to Naples and maybe parts of other territories in Italy. So you can see that creates a new balance in Europe if England is allied to the maritime nation of Spain, also still strongly allied to Portugal. So it's the kind of thing that Henry is kind of thought through, and he thinks, well, you know, we can make this a different dynamic for our future family on the throne to link to this power. And obviously he does know by then that Spain and England are kind of discovering, you know, the American lands and the opportunities of another way of seeing how maritime power works. So it's the cusp of something, and Arthur is a key part of this. And it's a tough negotiation right through the 1480s and 90s. There's lots of proxy arrangements, lots of ambassadorial visits. There's kind of tours of the estate in the marches. You know, everything is spruced up. They rebuild a house of Richard, Duke of York at Tickenhill, a place called Bewdley, which is on the River Severn, which is a kind of country house, not the ancient fortress of Ludlow, which is massive. And, you know, it's the sort of place you stage an army before it marches into Wales to crush some kind of uprising. So it's very much Arthur's kingdom, really, that Catherine comes into. He's only just before then become much more visible around London. I think once they decide this marriage can actually happen, and the reason it can happen is that those pretenders that have plagued Henry in the late 1480s, Lambert Simnel, who's claiming to be the Earl of Warwick, who's actually, you know, the last Plantagenet's son. So he's the son of George, Duke of Clarence, who's Richard III, Edward IV's brother, therefore, you know, a cast iron Yorkist prince. Henry VII locks him up in the Tower in fairly comfortable conditions, but nevertheless, he can't walk the streets and acquire support. And then the kind of solution that Henry has found to make himself king with the Yorkist supporters really comes back to bite him, because the next pretender claims to be an escaped prince in the Tower, Prince Richard, who reappears, and we've heard a lot about that recently, and lays claim to all this former Yorkist support, which through Elizabeth of York has been lent to the Tudors, but now as a elder son, well, not an elder son to Elizabeth, but as a male heir, the surviving eldest male heir of Edward IV, that's a legitimate claim on people's loyalty above the loyalty they have through Elizabeth to Henry Tudor. So suddenly you've got this standoff again between the political players. And if nothing else, it's about how they think about this problem. Whether it's true or not, it makes people question where they sit in the discussion and therefore what they would do if they had to make a choice and make some action. So some people do jump and try to think of certainly Perkin Warbeck, maybe Prince Richard, but possibly linked to that is the Earl of Warwick in the background as a very true figurehead who people can actually rally around. And the whole thing causes Henry an awful lot of problems in the 1490s. He promotes his second son, Henry, to be Duke of York to kind of refute this idea that another Duke of York has survived. Henry is kind of made central to the court function. He becomes very much the kind of court mascot when he's only 5 or 6 and has a life in the royal nursery. He's not kind of built up as a power broker in parallel to Arthur. There's no two centers of power. There's only the king, Prince Arthur. So Henry is a court creature, which, you know, we can see in his later life is a symptom of this early education. But let's put that to one side. But the pretenders, eventually Warbeck and Warwick are kind of brought together at the end of the 1490s, having defeated a Cornish rebellion, a southwestern rebellion in 1497. Warbeck is locked up eventually, but he's given a chance to work in the royal household. He's not executed. He keeps trying to run away. And eventually he ends up in the Tower, and there's probably a manufactured conspiracy to attach he and Warwick in a kind of treasonable conversation. And in November 1499, they're both pretty much executed at the same time, which on the one hand ends the idea of a Prince Richard surviving, but also ends the idea of a legitimate Prince Edward of Warwick, Plantagenet. So two Plantagenet aspects of that kind of Yorkist heritage, Henry snuffs out immediately. And that's why the marriage to Catherine of Aragon can happen in what look like stable circumstances. So the Spanish ambassador are constantly looking for this kind of end to the plotting, end to the conspiracy, end to the threat that Henry Tudor might be taken off the throne, you know, even in a few weeks, as he'd done to Richard III. You know, it was less than a month between him landing and the Battle of Bosworth. So had, say, Maximilian Habsburg and the Burgundians decided to launch another army into England as the French had supported Henry Tudor, the Spanish investment in England would have been wasted, because there is a cash dowry at the basis of this, which Henry is very pleased to receive. So he wants to make these circumstances, you know, cast iron for the Spanish princess to come, for this alliance to be forged through the marriage, then through another branch of kind of, I suppose, connected ancestry, because Catherine is also linked back to John of Gaunt and Edward III through Constance of Lancaster. So Constance of Castile marrying John of Gaunt. So there's an existing claim there, which again is coming back to help the Tudors, but also help them on a much bigger scale in terms of European politics. So yes, Arthur and Catherine are married. It really is the most spectacular wedding I guess England had ever seen in terms of public spectacle. It really costs a lot of money. It takes over the whole of London in these spectacular pageants. It doesn't help that she is delayed. She's supposed to land at Southampton in October. She ends up landing at Plymouth in early November and has this breakneck journey across across England, and basically arrives right as these ceremonies are meant to happen. But it's still, you know, it must be so spectacular because it's so well reported. So we have great detail about what went on, not only in the public areas, but in the palaces and in the rooms, and Henry being a gracious kind of host, the banqueting, the amount of heraldry and again badges and emphasis on ancestry and fitness to rule and legitimacy. But by this stage, the Tudors are kind of laying it on so thick, you'd really think they'd been in power for hundreds of years already. So in that sense, the Spanish are happy. And obviously King Ferdinand is a major figure. So he sent his ambassadors to ensure that this is all a legitimate and worthwhile investment. And by December, I think they decide they could have stayed in London, but I think there's another pretender on the horizon then. Not really a pretender, but it's Edmund de la Poole, who's another nephew of the Yorkist house. His brother had been one of the principal rebels early in Henry VII's reign. He'd been responsible for the uprising that led to the Battle of Stoke in 1487, when Henry did have to take to the battlefield again. His brother, Edmund, and his other brother, Richard, basically try to organize another international conspiracy to throw Henry off the throne. And at the time of the wedding, he's just fled overseas to kind of be out of England's control and to try and round up support for, well, just like Henry had done, money and mercenaries to come back and have a direct challenge. But that comes to nothing. But it's a slight worry, which probably means they send Arthur and Catherine back to Ludlow around about Christmas 1501, the start of 1502. So they only have 6 months of married life together, very early in the spring, 1502. We don't really know what's going on there, but Arthur is in public for the kind of Easter ceremonies, Easter 1502. He's giving out the maundy money to poor people, performing like a king in miniature in his own region. But on the 2nd of April, he's suddenly dead. And it's absolutely devastating, probably from a sweating sickness, a kind of pandemic-like flu, which first appears in England with the French army that comes over with Henry Tudor in 1485, periodically flares up in different places. And we know from some mortality returns that there's quite a big outbreak of illness right down the marches at this time. Worcester becomes a closed city. There's real problems to such an extent that they really have to decide who they can send to Arthur's funeral, because it's not safe to send any of the royal family. Not that the kings and queen would normally go, but, you know, almost have to draw lots to see who can represent the crown. So it's still a kind of hotbed of disease. And so Arthur is he's not buried for about 3 weeks after his death, until he's towards the end of April, and he's processed from Ludlow Castle down to Worcester Priory, and buried in what is now Worcester Cathedral. But incredibly solemn, very moving kind of account of this from the heralds and the household officers who were there. All of that investment in his training is kind of immediately cut off. Catherine of Aragon probably nearly dies as well. There's enough evidence in the accounts of the funeral equipment and the arrangements that she is not really very well, which might account for the delay, because I didn't know whether she would survive. But her role is there as a mourner. They send the Earl of Surrey, who'd actually fought against Henry VII, Henry Tudor at Bosworth, but has integrated himself to such an extent that he's now almost indispensable as one of the chief ministers of the crown. So he represents the king. But it's a terrible event for a kind of change of direction and a massive disappointment for all of those plans. And the king is the queen are at Greenwich at Placentia Palace, and they hear the news. A rider that rides pretty much nonstop over 3 days to get to them. And there's a very moving account of how the news is received and how they comfort each other. But as a result of that, they kind of retreat a little bit, as Henry does when he receives bad news. I think bad news seems to have a physical effect on him, certainly when another pretender jumps up around this time. It's just a priest from Cambridge who says, I'm the Earl of Warwick, or somebody. He goes white overnight. His hair turns white with the shock. So it has a physical effect on him, and this death really does drag him right back into what's possibly already a persistent pattern of illness. He's probably himself got tuberculosis already, which flares up every spring with a throat infection and coughing, and very debilitating. And people begin to notice this more regularly now after the turn of the century. So Arthur's death certainly creates these circumstances where all of this physical manifestation is more emphasized every time bad news arrives, or when these springtime patterns come back. But Elizabeth and Henry decide to try and have another child. Prince Edmund had died in 1500. There's Margaret and Princess Mary. But there's a loss from Prince Arthur, which they try to rectify. Elizabeth becomes pregnant again, aged 35, I think. So that year is a kind of 1503 is... 1502, right through the second half of that year. Again, back to expectation and hope. Obviously, Prince Henry is now the only son, but he's only aged 11. Turns 11 during that year. But the next blow is that Elizabeth of York dies shortly after giving birth in February 1503 on her birthday. So within a year, the king has lost his eldest son, and his wife. Prince Henry's lost his brother, who he doesn't really know, I'm sure, hasn't really had a lot of contact with. But losing his mother is a massive blow to Henry, right on the early teenage phase of his life. And this creates a real sense of chaos and uncertainty. And it sort of tips Henry into a real repressive frame of mind, not necessarily to squash everything and everybody, but literally to ensure that Prince Henry can become the king at some point, because Henry is more aware of his own mortality because of these increasing bouts of illness.
Right.
Prince Henry has to be at least ushered into, 15, 16, 17, where he can become, as the strapping youth that he is, at least somebody who could survive long enough to galvanize enough support to get him over the line as an 18-year-old or a 21-year-old to rule in his own right. The problem is he's had none of this training to be a leader. He's had plenty of training to be a courtier, and he knows about managing relationships and being smooth and very well educated, really good at French and Latin, had really good tutors. He's already absolutely completely in love with jousting, to the point where he would do nothing else, maybe a bit of hunting and hawking, but really he wants to be practicing on the battlefield, or for the battlefield. He wants to be Henry V, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, the way is clear for him to become king, but there's still a massive gulf in abilities and experience and age. So Henry VII can see his dynasty disappearing already unless he can really safeguard that last process for, say, the next 6 or 7 years, which is why the period from 1503 right through to 1509, when he does die, is a very unusual and kind of dark period of clamping down. And Henry, he doesn't really rule through Parliament anymore. He doesn't ask for taxes anymore. He looks to these ancient relationships between the crown and the chief nobles who hold land directly from the crown. And he basically starts to fine people for any element of that relationship and interconnection with the crown. So when they inherit their lands from their fathers or mothers, you know, there's a fine for that. There's lots of fines if you allow people to escape from your prison, if you're an abbot or a bishop. There's fines for anything which requires the king's assent or his agreement. So people would petition for a grant or whatever. You know, everything gets inflated. There's lots of spies and what are called approvers in London who are sort of sucking up information to the benefit of the king. People who are evading customs or marrying without license. It just looks like a regime interested in making money out of people's links to each other and to the crown. But this is all just part of the bigger picture of stopping anyone rising up, building up their resources to the extent where they can try and topple Henry and also topple Prince Henry. So you could understand why, having lost his wife and his son, Henry reverts back to this kind of desperation to keep hold of the crown. But for everybody else, it's a really difficult period. They must be desperate for Henry to survive and also to basically bring all these characteristics to bear in his own right, which they can begin to see happening, you know, by the time he does become king, aged just under 18, you know, the stage is set for a spectacular return, but it's almost like the clouds have gone and the sun's come out again. Everyone is relieved. Obviously, no one can say this, that Henry VII has gone, because, you know, he's dragged the country back down into a nervous kind of watchful way of existing, looking for rebellions, looking for plots, not really governing, just keeping things contained. And there's all the negotiations about, you know, his own possible second marriage. Prince Henry, is he going to marry Catherine of Aragon or look for another wife? Mm. And there's a lot of, you know, there's links to the Italian wars. Diplomacy takes over a much more important role, I think. Henry's vision of where England sits in how politics have unfolded around Europe. Not a major player, certainly not the kind of major player it would become in the 16th century in Elizabeth I's reign, when the overseas links really do get exploited. But Henry is using every tool he's got to stay in power. And he's no longer an open-handed king. He's suspicious and he's nervous. And he is very wary of his second son disappearing too. So
yeah,
you can understand why. It just means that Prince Henry is champing at the bit, either to get out of that control or to have a way to do what Prince Arthur had done, is to have his own area to trial this. But, you know, Henry the King won't allow this because he needs him under wraps and in cotton wool.
Right. And people do sort of remember that part of Henry the VII's reign, that sort of paranoid, suspicious part of his reign, forgetting who he was prior to those two very important deaths, Arthur's death and Elizabeth's death. And as you say, people are waiting for Henry VIII. And I feel like Henry VII just wills himself to live. His health is continuing to fall and wills himself to live until Henry is almost 18, close enough to really step into that and treat his father's hard work a bit like a playground. But in any case, what Henry VII does over his reign, over his life, but over his reign, by taking the crown and holding the crown and preparing the country for Henry VIII to step in a very peaceful transfer of power and to just be in a wealthy country. Henry VIII inherits a very wealthy royal household and starts spending. So it's extraordinary what Henry VII is able to do. And I would like to ask you, because I know you research a lot about Henry VII, I understand there's a Penguin series with an upcoming book. Is that right? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Penguin have published a series with a book on each monarch of England. So I'm doing the Henry VII one, and it's been ready. It's just waiting in a queue to be published. I think it should be out at the end of this year. Okay. But I just need to confirm, because it seems to be on various websites, has a publication date. So it's a shortish book, but it's trying to tell this story in a kind of bigger picture, I suppose, of these bigger problems, and try to put the king at the center of it, and how, you know, kings were so important in the tone of the country and how countries were run. They kind of controlled all of the institutions and the mechanisms for how the country worked. And it's about personalities and how they got on. And when those things failed, you know, it was easier for things to fall apart or require interventions to get control again. So it's a short but very exciting read, which tries to tell this story. You know, to put Henry is often forgotten about at the start of the Tudors, mm-hmm. And it does stop the country continually fighting civil war, and it's. Right. And if you think about Henry IV's problems with the Percys back in, you know, the very first years of the century, the 15th century, there had been constant fighting amongst the nobility. And it's only the war in France which basically got everybody on the same, pointing in the same direction.
Yeah.
And when that goes wrong, the Wars of the Roses come back into force.
Right.
As a focus for people. And that could have carried on had Henry VII not been able to stop all of this. And some of it was fairly ruthless, as he did with the Earl of Warwick. Some of this was through quite careful cultivation of people. Uh-huh. Some of it was managing those people with the power. So the Stanley family, who had been power brokers right through the Wars of the Roses with great resources, because they were able to control a lot of the crown estates in the northwest through the Duchy of Lancaster, the sort of king's private estates. Mm-hmm. Which were inherited from the Duke of Lancaster in 1399 when he became Henry IV. So the Stanleys have got great power, but there's a careful kind of campaign to use Margaret Beaufort's marriage to Lord Stanley
to manage,
kind of control them and get them to work for the crown, or at least think about the crown on an equal footing to their own power. And that's kind of how Henry VII works with the other great families, you know, restoring some people, keeping mm-hmm. some people at arm's length. So the Duke of Buckingham, the Earl of Northumberland, become powerful figures again during his reign. And these are, you know, if you go back through the civil wars, back to the 1450s, these are people whose families have been right there all the way through, offering thousands of troops to the battlefield, running their estates as if they're just under the level of the king.
Right.
You know, wealthy people who rule in a mirror image of the crown's kind of arrangements. So Henry's got to try and negotiate with these people on an equal footing, knowing that he's not really a credible noble, that he's got a title, but it's a fairly minor position in that spectrum of English royal aristocratic kind of power. Very important for practical kind of leadership terms. So how he manages to negotiate his way through all of this, largely by the end of the 15th century, you know, having got through the problems of the pretenders, sort of the problems that are self-inflicted through taxation and the tax rebellions, many of which are to fuel these kind of military expeditions to show England's contribution, or he's paying off the Habsburgs to keep control of potential rebels and pretenders, or he's sending money to the Holy League to help the Pope, you know, and the alliance against Venice, depending on which way round at any time those states are aligned. So he's constantly juggling all of these different aspects of being a king, having a standing start in 1485. I think it's quite impressive how he gets a handle on the way things work, he manages to make that function in support of Tudor power to ensure that first Arthur and then Henry are supported as potential heirs, next heirs. And eventually, despite a little blip where Henry VII's death is hidden for a couple of days, so they can arrest the ministers who'd been responsible for the kind of worst aspects of his final policy. There's rejoicing almost that, not so yes. much that, well, it looks like rejoicing that Prince Henry is now King Henry, but a lot of it must be rejoicing that Henry VII's ways have ended. But I think people possibly didn't realize by then what he'd managed to achieve to stop, you know, a civil war continuing into the 1490s, which is entirely possible.
Very possible. And he doesn't get the credit. I think very much people just zoom right to Henry VIII because it's all where all the fun stories are and sort of overlook what Henry VII really accomplished to get Henry VIII on the throne. So then we can march through. So thank you so much for taking us through this. I don't want to keep you all day. I could go on talking to you all day. This has been such a treat. But we will. I have seen the book, and I believe it is saying later this year it will be published. So I'll have all of that for readers. But thank you so much for being with us, for chatting about Henry VII, for bringing this elusive character to life for us and helping us understand all the work he did to get this fascinating dynasty started. Thank you so much. Now, where can we follow you? Social media, all those kinds of things.
Yes, I'm kind of on X, but pretty quiet at the moment. I mean, there's things that the National Archives website, you can pick up some of the things we're doing with the teams there. But yeah, any kind of talks and things like that, a lot of them come through work. So I do quite a lot of the talks on the medieval and modern topics. But yeah, it's really just trying to finish off these books at the moment.
Well, great.
Another big book on, we did a project called Tudor Chamber Books, myself and James Ross, which is basically the household accounts of Henry VII and Henry VIII up to 1530, including the account of Elizabeth of York. She had one account book, which is a fascinating read, her daily spending. So we did a digital edition of all of these, TudorChamberBooks.org. And you can basically just read through all the amazing payments for everything from oranges to £100,000 to bribe the Habsburgs not to invade England, that kind of thing.
Wow.
So there's a book coming out of that about the king's role in government in this period.
Oh,
so how did the king individually influence the way either those departments of state worked, but also how that relationship with all of the nobility and the corporations in towns and cities, how did that work as an individual application of kind of authority and personality. So we're at the point of sending that to Oxford University Press, and that should be out probably next year.
That's great. Oh, wonderful. We'll look for that too. That's wonderful. And I'll put the link, TudorChamberBooks.org.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating records, and we were pleased to do the project because it's bringing that personality in the context of the court really more into the spotlight.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I'll have all these in the show notes. So thank you again so much for being with us. And thank you everyone for listening. We'll look forward to another episode soon. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. Another big thank you to my patrons and to all of you for joining me as we keep shaking up history together. Thank you.